Who's calling him a genius?
That documentary.
Really? Is that what it was saying?
Like, no. Like 45% of Queen's University.
The Netflix one was called Genius.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
And the new one I saw you loved.
And the new one was like literally like one of the worst documentaries I think I've ever seen in my entire life.
It's not worth watching?
Definitely not worth watching. There's only one scene that's worth watching, which is Kanye interacting with Elon Musk.
Yeah.
Which is probably like the craziest thing I've ever seen.
What do they talk about?
They talk about
crimes. Do you think it sounds a little bit like this? Do you think it sounds a little bit like this?
No.
Maybe. Maybe because genius is talking with geniuses.
Yeah. Like, why does a bus have 30 seats and a Lamborghini only has 2?
Is this the same
girl? That's because only 2 people can make it big.
Mm-hmm. And that's a lot of relationships.
Why does the chicken breast take the flavor of the marinade?
And I say it's going to be lemon, but I put the spice in it. And I say, don't worry, it's going to taste
like
lemon.
It's going to burn your mouth.
And it's going to burn your mouth.
That's like what being in a relationship is.
Yeah.
Thank you guys for listening. I will see you next week and have a great rest of your Tuesday.
Bye.
Bye.
You're listening to Kingston's only campus community radio station, broadcasting 24/7, 365 on 101.9 FM and CFRC.ca. Tune in for the best local programming.
G'day and welcome to Grad Chat, your opportunity to find out about graduate research here at Queen's. My name is CJ the DJ and I am your host for this week's Grad Chat, and it's great to be back. Of course, a show like this could not happen without the support of the School of Graduate Studies and Postdoctoral Affairs as well as CFRC. So thank you very much to both of them. Now, if your mates miss the show at any time, you can download the podcast on either iTunes, Google Podcasts, Spotify, and CFRC Podcast. So no excuse not to hear what our awesome students and postdoctoral fellows are doing. So as I mentioned, I am back, but the reason I've come back is I want to introduce you to a very special lady who I've had the privilege to get to know. She is a Queen's alum, a CFRC alum, a well-known Canadian broadcaster, and is now the 16th Chancellor of Queen's University. So not one of our grad students, but she is the Chancellor of Queen's University. I would like to welcome to Grad Chat a woman with a very distinctive voice, Sheila Rogers. Welcome to Grad Chat, Sheila.
Thank you. And I am honored to be with CJ the DJ.
I know. It's a bit corny, isn't it? But it's kind of like everyone said, just do it. And I go, all right, then. And it's kind of stuck for the last 10 years. So there you go. So what's it like being back at CFRC where we would like to think you got your passion for radio?
I absolutely did develop my passion for radio. I can see you, and I believe I worked in that studio quite a bit. I recorded Dr. F.R.C. Clark doing a program. He was head of the music department, and the program was called The Music Department.
We're all so original, aren't we?
so original. But I loved working with him. I didn't get to talk to him on this program. It was his choices. Played a lot of Carl Nielsen. He loved Nielsen's music. Anyway, just seeing this reminds me of where I began. And I began to think about maybe I could do this for a living.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe I could. And in the studio where you're sitting right now, there was an old phone. I got a phone call from the Country and Western station downtown offering me a job.
Is that right?
That is true. I hung up on them because I was sure it was a joke, but it wasn't. They called back. And that was sort of the beginning of it. I still had 2 years to go before I finished my studies, but I went for it.
Well, it's interesting you say that because you know you've made it when you walk into the local cake shop and they recognize your voice.
Isn't that wonderful?
They don't know you, but they recognize the voice.
I always say it's my sister because she has the identical voice.
Oh, is that right?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. That's
genetics. It all depends on what they have to say.
Well, that's true. Then it's you. Otherwise, the other way. You started your career on CFRC. What prompted you to even get started with the radio station at CFRC? Because you were an undergrad here. What made you come to CFRC and say, you know, can I give this a go?
Well, it was my roommate, a woman named Mary Bruce, who became an occupational therapist. And I was listening to CFRC, and I heard somebody reading a record jacket. And I happened to have the very same record jacket. It was for Glenn Gould playing Bach's piano. Well, it was a harpsichord concerto originally, but a piano concerto in C minor. And I was actually reading along with her. And I said to Mary, this is ridiculous. You know, if you're on the radio, you shouldn't just be reading record jackets.
Right.
And I complained so much. And she finally said, if you think you can do a better job, you should just go down there. Now, I don't know whether I did a better job or not, but they were desperate. They were desperate for people to do classical music programs. So when I walked in the door, 3 weeks later, I was classical music director. But
brilliant. And of course, we've got such a great collection here, haven't we?
Such a great collection, and many of those vinyl LPs are still there. And I really think, I mean, I love listening to student radio. The spontaneity, the passion, and passion is something I do want to talk with you a bit about later on, but it always comes through. It always comes through. And that's what brought me there in the first place, Colette. It was a very interesting time. It would have been in the early, well, I guess 1973, 74, not too many years later, that CRTC would be looking for women and creating affirmative action programs to get women hired on radio stations, to hear female voices. It's not that long ago, but there were very few. So my timing was good as well.
Well, I think, I mean, I keep saying this to our students, you know, any of them can do a program here. I mean, CFRC, as we know, is always looking for new programming, not syndicated programming. And there's nothing better than listening to a student voice because they've got a lot to say, whether it's in their field of studies or advocacy work or anything like that. So, you know, I'll keep pushing for that. Come on down, because they train you and everything, and they're volunteer positions, and you can learn so much, can't you, from it?
Absolutely. And it's all about communication. Either you're doing interviews or you're presenting your own story. And both are just really important skills to have. I don't know that they were ever more important than they are now to make your story stand out and to express it. So I think CFRC is a jewel.
It is a jewel. And we're lucky to be a part of it.
So lucky. And I'm so thrilled it's still going strong.
Now, I was speaking to a friend the other day and mentioned I was going to interview you, and they started laughing. And so I asked why, and they said it was because they used to watch CKWS weather just because you were on it. What made you want to be a weather girl? How was that? That's a little bit different because you're out front in front of a TV screen.
Yeah, I would say nothing made me want to be a weather girl. But I was called the weather girl. The way it went down was like this, Colette. I was actually doing a classical music program at CFMKFM, which was the country station right above the TV studio of CKWS. And one night, the late night weatherman didn't come in.
Oh, right.
And the fellows who were running master control and television called me and said, there are no other on-air people in the building. Can you come down and do the weather? And listen, I was dressed for radio. I was wearing a flannel shirt and a pair of jeans, and I didn't know my H from my L, but I just kind of read it, and it was very spontaneous. I had to be very honest. I told people I didn't know what I was talking about. And a week later, I was on that shift permanently until one night, after about 2 weeks of solid rain, and you know the rain you get in Kingston. There's no pussyfooting around it. It can be very, very powerful. I'd been raining for 2 weeks, and I was getting dressed up for Halloween as a duck. So I thought, I'm just going to wear my duck costume.
That's probably what got them.
That probably was what it was. And so I just did the weather straight. And then at the end, I said, it's not good weather, not even for a duck. And then they went to the commercial. The next morning, I was fired.
Oh, no, you're kidding.
No, but then the next afternoon, that same afternoon, I was hired and paid $10 a weather forecast. People called in and said, what is she going to do tonight?
So that was pressure for you, you know,
that
what outfit?
Was pressure, and I didn't give into it every single night. I couldn't. I would would have run out of things pretty quickly. But I would say it was an early form of performance art.
Yes, for sure. Well, I mean, today they just bring in their dog, you know, their dogs with them. I mean, absolutely. Dressing up as a duck is so much better.
Well, it only happened once, but I still meet people who saw it, which is incredibly, I don't know if it's thrilling or embarrassing, maybe a bit of both.
So you've been on CBC. Mm-hmm. In fact, that was the majority of your professional career, being on CBC Radio with programs like Morningside, The Arts Tonight, This Morning, The Next Chapter. You're very much into the arts, different forms of arts, aren't you? And performing arts, music, theatre, mm-hmm. all those sorts of things. With that, you were also a big champion of mental health advocacy and adult literacy. Yeah. And also a big part of the Truth and Reconciliation Commission, and particularly with the work that your cousin, of course, our 15th Chancellor, the Honourable Murray Sinclair, led. But what I found interesting is that your part in the TRC was amplifying the voices of Indigenous peoples. How important has it been for you to be able to use your voice to help communicate for others?
I have a very strange affectation, Colette. Microphones don't make me nervous. They might make most people nervous. Public speaking doesn't make me nervous. It's real life that right. makes me nervous. But because I have this, I don't really know what to call it. It has been a gift, so why don't I just call it that? I feel I should be using it for people who do feel they can't go in front of a microphone mm-hmm. and they can't tell their story, or I can sit with them and help them tell their story into a microphone so that other people can hear it. It's sort of a pay it forward, I guess.
Right.
I've been very lucky with what I've been able to do, as you mentioned the great programs that I was able to work on. And, you know, interestingly, not always about the arts, often science, current affairs, areas that I had to really buff up my learning skills, mm-hmm. my critical thinking skills, which I really believe I developed at Queen's, and get interested in other stories than the ones that were my milieu. And using my voice for other people's stories is a very big responsibility, in particular acting as an honorary witness to the testimonies of residential school survivors. I took many, many notes. I look at the notes frequently so that I know I'm still telling the story correctly when right. When I share their stories. But your job, and I think this is your job as a journalist as well, you stand for the truth of what you've witnessed.
Right.
And I witnessed probably 1,000 testimonies. My beloved late cousin, Murray Iban, which means ancestor, witnessed thousands. He listened to thousands and thousands. But the ones I heard, and when I hear people denying residential school or denying or saying it was a good thing, I can say, well, I heard these 1,000 voices, and here's what happened to them. And you wouldn't call this good. So I think it's being able to stand for the truth. Again, I'm not afraid to stand up in front of a microphone, or when I see something wrong, mm-hmm. call it. Something just sort of rises up in me and I have to do it. Damn the torpedoes and damn the consequences. But I also have been so very lucky to be well-trained. I had wonderful mentors. I had great mentors at CFRC. And I'm able to feel secure in that world.
Telling someone else's story is not an easy thing to do.
It's an honor and a responsibility. Mm-hmm. And you bring in every sense that you've got to it. Listening is the key thing. And you're right. I think we become, well, a friend of mine who used to be the president of Nipissing University, Mike DeGagne, said we become sloppy listeners. And a lot of this is because of social media and everything's in little chunks and sound bites and so on, that we don't sort of bask in just the wonderful glory of listening to a long story or you know, well, audiobooks are very popular, and I think that's really great. Podcasts also similarly, yes, so popular. I see these as really good indications that we want to be good listeners, you know,
right.
But it really means, and actually I can give, I'll tell you a little story. I met a survivor, a woman I'd worked with in adult literacy. I didn't know she'd gone to residential school, and I just started bombarding her with questions. And she put her hand up and just said, "Sheila, you just have to shut up and listen." And it was bracing in the moment, but it was a very important lesson that listen and silent have the same letters in them. And I think that must be intentional at some subconscious right. level. And you just pull back and quit trying to get your brilliant thought in there. Just receive the story and maybe even hold it for a few seconds. You don't have to have an immediate response. Just take it in. I think that has a lot to do with listening with your ears, but also with your heart. And that's a practice.
It's interesting you say that, because in the interviews here, I'm constantly butting in because I suddenly have a thought from what someone's just told me. I go, I go off on a tangent. And yeah. But I mean, I tell them in the beginning, that's probably what I'm going to do, because I want them to think on their feet too. You know, I've distracted you going somewhere else. Can you pull it back in? But you're right, though, in terms of generally, interview aside, yeah, let the person speak.
It's all about who you're interviewing, mm-hmm. I think. If you're talking to a politician and they're going to try to give you the old message track, you do want to get in there. You want to take them off that track.
Right.
And get them speaking like a human being.
That's difficult.
Well, you know, and it's former communicators, former broadcasters that are training politicians to give the answers that they want, but not necessarily the answers that an interviewer or journalist needs.
Right.
And heavens, you're working for the public. Anyway, that's a digression of my own making, my dear.
Okay, well, we'll move on. So you're now the Chancellor of Queen's, a role you have taken on before at the University of Victoria. So they gave you a bit of a grounding. What prompted you to take on this role at another university? Because it's not everyone thinks it's just this grand position that you get to stand on stage. But as we know, convocations can be quite long and it can be very tiring standing on that stage. But it's more than just that. It's, you know, you're at board meetings, you're out there helping the university. So what made you want to take on that role again?
Well, UVic was a complete and utter surprise. I wasn't an alumna. I got a call from the president at that point, Jamie Castles, saying, "I'd like to take you out for lunch." And I thought, well, that sounds very nice, Jamie Castles. I'd love to have lunch with you. And he and the board chair, Dr. Eric Moore, said, "We would like to invite you to be chancellor." I had no idea what it meant, Colette. No idea whatsoever. But I thought if there were a way to make some kind of positive change, and at this point, it was 2015, so the TRC was just wrapping up, the Truth and Reconciliation mm-hmm. Commission. I thought if we could try to put some of the calls to action into place at UVic, if we could try to move forward the three Indigenous communities that the university stands on, if they had more prominence, if there was a greater partnership,
right,
maybe I could work on that. And it turned out that there were things that I could do and I could move the dial. It's the chancellor role is a very funny role because you've got a wand that is about this big and I'm holding up a little pen, a very little pen.
It's a nice colored pen, but it's a little pen.
But you can talk to people. I think the way it's been put in my mind too is that you have some influence but not power. And you have to be very careful not to interfere with the operating mm-hmm. of the university. Mm-hmm. That's not your place. So why would I want to do it again? The reason, well, there are a couple of reasons. First of all, Principal Patrick Dean called me and presented it to me at first, and then Murray called, and he was still chancellor then, yeah, and said, "I think this is a very good idea, and you should do it." And he said, "I'm asking you to do it." So I couldn't really say no to him. It was a chance to honor my alma mater, and
right,
it was a chance to say thank you for what I learned there, the friends I made there, the friends I still have, and really getting started on a career that that gave me a great deal of satisfaction and meaning in my life. So I thought it would be a chance to put something back in. And I've only been in that role for 1 year, though it feels like more, but I mean that in a good way. People have been wonderful. Working with the Indigenous leadership and the senior leadership team and bringing them together to see how we can move things forward for Queens. And I see some really positive changes there, too.
That's good.
Meeting the students has been really thrilling. And Nikki Boychuk-Hale, who's our student, the rector, has become a really dear friend. And I feel as though I have a good understanding of what students are facing at Queen's and how I can step in, perhaps, and move things along.
Well, I think that's important. I mean, what you've been saying is, you know, all your work that you've done to this point, you are now able to use to help in this particular role. And I think that's an important thing for all of us to remember, is that as we're going through our life, we're learning so much.
Yes.
But we need to make sure that then we can pass that on as well, or give guidance, or whatever we want, whatever word we want to call it. And again, that's all about using our communication skills to give back.
Completely, Colette. I think that's a really, really good point. And I think about what I learned at Queen's, but I never stopped learning. And I really think about continuous learning through your life and continuing education. And I think that's something that Queen's can offer everybody who's ever graduated, or everyone who hasn't. Come to Queen's.
Come to Queen's.
It's a great place.
So you're getting to meet, as you said, a lot of students, both undergrad and grad, and hearing about their studies, ambitions, their thoughts of student life. How have you found our students in explaining these elements of their university life? I mean, are they explaining things well, or is it just more the ones that are speaking, the ones that are more on the advocacy side? I mean, because I like to think there's a bit of both. I mean,
I would say
university life isn't all bad. I mean, there's a lot of good things about university life. Is it always great? No, there's things, but that's like in anything in life.
I think I hear from both people who are accomplished advocates and really want me to join them in their advocacy. And my role, I have to be very careful here, too. I'm an advocate for some things, but again, if it's in the way the university is running, I can speak to people, but I can't necessarily change people. But I do want to listen. I do want to hear what they're feeling on the ground.
Right.
I am actually, to be honest, Colette, blown away by how articulate and eloquent our students are. I think the people who are more hesitant, perhaps that's more of a shyness issue and feeling they maybe can't put the story together, but I know they can. I know they can. And I know they can go out and they can change things and they can frame things so that people will understand what their passions are, what their story is, what they're advocating for. I know they can do that.
Right.
A place like CFRC is a great place to learn how to do that. Your airtime is limited. You can't sort of sit back and figure out all your thoughts for hours and hours and hours. You've got to know what you're going to do. So how do you frame what you need to get across?
Yes.
How do you make it sound human?
And how do you engage the audience? Because that's a big thing that I always talk about. You've got to engage the audience. Be the audience when you're thinking about how you say things.
Exactly. Making that connection. Mm-hmm. I think it all depends on your platform. If you're looking at radio, I've always believed that there's only one set of ears that you're talking to at a time. So if I'm in the bathroom brushing my teeth in the morning and I hear our morning show host say, "Good morning, Manitoba," I'm looking around like, who else is in the bathroom here with me? It's just
and
me.
Why are they?
And what are they doing here? And how did they get in? But it's really a one-on-one. It's one mouth to your ears.
Right.
And I've always thought that immediately creates an intimacy when you use second person singular as opposed to second person plural.
Right.
And that is, I think, it builds connection, it builds understanding, and it builds engagement. And when I'm just talking to you mm-hmm. right now, I'm not talking to anybody else. I know people are listening.
Right.
I'm thrilled out of my head that they are. But this is our conversation. And so I'm not going to say many of you or some of you. It'll just be you. That was it sounds very small, but it was a shortcut to engagement, a shortcut to a kind of intimacy. People feel that they know radio hosts. I bet, well, as you say, you meet people in Kingston, they know you. And that's because of how you are on the radio. You know, you're friendly, you're warm. I'm not saying everyone has to be friendly and warm, but to be able to communicate what you need to communicate is what we're after here, and what's going to set our grads in really good stead as they graduate.
Do you think that's one of the important words you said, that, you know, the intimacy of the one-on-one? So regardless of whether our students are talking about their research at a conference or writing a journal article, what a lot of people are going to be reading, thinking about, I'm just talking to one person right now, or writing to one person, or videoing a film for one person to help with that connection. Because you can get really scared knowing there's 1,000 people watching you.
Yes, exactly.
But you don't get so scared if it's one-on-one.
I think that's a really good point. And you may be out in front talking to 1,000 people, but I think you have to bear in mind that each one of those 1,000 people is an individual.
Right.
And I think that's where it probably will settle best. Mm-hmm. You do have to know who your audience is as much as you possibly can, and gear your communication, gear your story towards them, especially if you're presenting something at a conference. I mean, that, mm-hmm. Hopefully you do know who you'll be speaking with. But there's nothing, I think everybody, we're storytelling beings. I think we thrive on stories. And that stories are what we hold. We may not go holding our statistics or our data, but we do hold stories. And right. I think that's just a human impulse. So learning how to create a story, how to turn research into a story, how to make it relatable. I think about this young woman who appeared before university council, studying music. She was in her fourth year, and noticed that in a lot of video games, they were using Gregorian chant. And So she decided, I'm going to find out what those chants are. I'm going to study medieval music, see how they place it into Game of Thrones-like video games.
Right.
And it was totally fascinating. And people started hearing the music thinking, I was never interested in Gregorian chant until I see how it related to video games. I mean, It's just the elasticity of creative thinking.
But I think that's also too with now, you know, granting agencies and employers hiring people, they're looking at more than just the interview skill. They're looking at, you know, what can you put in a video or in a blog? What do you do on blogs? Your writing skills, etc. It's a real combination these days. And some people who may be nervous speaking themselves, mm-hmm. put a video together to explain what you do, what your work is.
Absolutely.
Because that some people are better at doing visuals as opposed to the oration. So find the one, our grad students need to find the one that works best for them.
Exactly.
And then really work on that.
I think you're absolutely right. Yeah. I'm not a visual person. I have never, I mean, when I do give a talk, it's just me.
Right.
I haven't used slides. I mean, it's unbelievable how cave I am. I've just crawled out of the cave. But it's really, I podcast though, and I was one of the early podcasters in Canada. The CBC locked us out, and I thought, well, darn it, we're still going to broadcast. So I learned how to podcast, and necessity will help you out too.
Right.
But you're right. I mean, maybe you're not a big fan of the microphone, but you're a great writer, and there's so many ways to write and combine visuals. It's incredible what you can do all by yourself.
Yeah. Very true. I mean, this is why I like our events, like the 3-minute thesis, which is all about the duration, or grad flicks, which is a 1-minute video or a research trailer, I like to call them. And hopefully I can get you involved in some of those things, because I think you would find it fabulous as well. And I know the students.
You're not going to leave us then.
Oh, no, I'm living in Kingston. I'm here for a while, yes.
I'll be involved then for sure.
Yes, because I think you will absolutely love it. So, Sheila, it's been an absolute pleasure chatting with you. Thanks for still being involved with your alma mater. And thanks for your support you are giving our students and basically just for being you. I know when speaking to Nikki, her eyes light up when she talks about you. So, you know, and that's just one student. And I know you've had interactions with a lot of other students as well as faculty and staff. So thank you very much. And I really appreciate your time.
Thank you, Colette. And honestly, I love what you're doing here. Grad Chat's fantastic. And happy 10th anniversary to Grad Chat.
That's
really exciting.
Thank you.
And thank you for your listening, too, and everything you've done for our graduates, too.
Oh, I love it. Thank you. So that's it, everyone. Another week of Grad Chat sadly comes to an end, and I would love this to keep going. But don't forget, you can download the show tomorrow from either iTunes, Google Podcasts, Spotify, or Stitcher. Just type in a Grad Chat. Until next week, this is CJ the DJ signing off with a big hooray.
Today on Wings, the Beijing agenda today.
The high-level meeting of the General Assembly on the 30th anniversary of the 4th World Conference on Women is called to order.
There's a river of birds in migration, a nation of women with wings.
Welcome to Wings, a series of news and current affairs programs by and about women around the world, produced and distributed by the Women's International News Gathering Service.
September 22, 2025, the President of the United Nations General Assembly convened heads of nations, organizations, and UN bodies to tell what they had done to fulfill the promises of the 4th World Conference on Women, and what obstacles stand in their way. Here are excerpts, starting with opening remarks of the General Assembly President herself, Annalena Baerbock.
Human rights are women rights, and women rights are human rights. When these famous words were spoken by Hillary Clinton 30 years ago in Beijing, they were revolutionary. If our daughters heard this today, wouldn't they rather think, why would women's rights not be human rights? Our daughters, who are the fastest sprinter in their high school, our daughters, who are CEO of an AI startup, our daughters who have watched their mothers become the first female president of the Marshall Islands, of Namibia, North Macedonia, Peru, of Slovenia, or Suriname. All presidents joining us here today. Many of you, of us here in this room, held positions that when we ourselves were young seemed unattainable, but are now almost normal for the next generation. Because we stand on the shoulders of women who paved the way forward for us. Mr. Secretary General, Excellencies, feminist leaders, ladies and gentlemen, today we celebrate the courageous women who fought for every single phrase, for every single word in the Beijing Declaration. Their fight paid off, advancing women's rights, resources, and representation. Mama Mongella stated in 1995, a revolution has begun. There's no going back. Yet, 30 years later, the revolution remains unfinished. When highly qualified CEOs are called diversity hires, we remember how far we still have to go. There's no country in the world where women's rights are purely equal to men. And there are still too many places where even speaking about women's rights is a matter of life and death. Just weeks ago in Afghanistan, after the deadly earthquake, women and girls were left trapped in rubble as male rescuers were forbidden from touching them. As one survivor said, being a woman here means we are always the last to be seen. We see this also in Sudan, where the brutal civil war between two generals is literally being fought over women's bodies. I still have her voice in my ear. When one mother told me, sitting with her in a refugee camp, that she wishes that they all would have been simply killed, instead of having to see her daughters being raped over and over again. This year alone, demand for life-saving post-rape support in Sudan increased almost 4 times. And this is no exception. 1 in 3 women globally will experience sexual violence at some point in her lifetime. 1 out of 3. This is us. And these battles extend to family planning. UNFPA estimates that today a quarter of women are unable to make decisions about their own health care, and roughly half of all pregnancies are unintended. Delivering on Beijing, on this revolution, means also that no male politician, judge or religious leader should dare to tell our girls what to do with their bodies. Cecilia Suarez is using her platform to speak out against this scourge in Latin America and the Caribbean, affecting as many as 76% of women in the region. But even in the darkest hours, women are not victims. They are survivors. They are heroes. Nadia Murad, Nobel laureate, not only survived the unthinkable crimes of ISIS, but gave Yazidi women a voice and by that defeated a terrorist organization. Women like Nadia Murad remind us that women rights are not only human rights, but human rights are the best weapon for peace. Excluding women peace builders doesn't just reduce the possibility of peace, it undermines its very foundation and longevity. Therefore, we are celebrating today not only Beijing, but also 25 years of Resolution 1325 on women, peace and security. Excellencies, Beijing and Resolution 1325 promised not only rights, but also resources. And there, the revolution has barely begun. At the current rate, reaching economic equality will take 123 years. But women's economic empowerment is not just about doing a favor for women, but a favor for every society, every economy. As they say, it's economics, stupid. Closing the gender gap would increase global GDP by $7 trillion. Which brings us to the third R, representation. We all know that when women are at the table, companies perform better, peace treaties last longer, and governments deliver more. Their presence is power. Yet, in this hall of principles, last year, fewer than 10% of speakers during high-level week were women. And out of all 80 presidents of the General Assembly, I'm only the fifth woman. Not even speaking about the Secretary General, where in 80 years we have never had a female SG. This is, as we can hear, not just a matter of representation, it's a matter of credibility to practice what we preach. But it's not only who is leading, it is how we lead. Leadership means collaboration. The theme of this 80th session overall is better together. A motto which also guided Beijing, where so many women came together in networks like FemNet, led by Memory Kachamba, a guest speaker here also today. Ladies and gentlemen, today we celebrate this spirit of better together. Tomorrow we go back to work. As female presidents, as male president, as Olympic sprinters, as CEOs, as ordinary mothers and daughters. And just in case, while finishing the revolution from Beijing, we might hear that contemptuous phrase, you run like a girl, we should remember what little girls all around the world would do. Exactly that. Fast as hell, even in high heels, showing that women rights are always human rights, that they are our rights, our future. I now invite the Secretary General of the United Nations, His Excellency Antonio Guterres, to make a statement.
The Beijing Declaration and Platform for Action has helped to power advances in some critical areas: legal protection, political participation, education, maternal mortality, recognizing the need to tackle violence against women as a global priority, and more. But progress has been slow and uneven, and no nation has achieved full equality for women and girls. Sustainable Development Goal 5, gender equality, is lagging far behind. Hard-won gains are now under attack. Meanwhile, conflicts and climate disasters are multiplying, and the human rights of women and girls are casualties of both. Cultural and structural barriers remain entrenched, and technology is spreading hate like a virus. A wave of misogyny is rolling across the world. Let us be clear. Equal rights and opportunities are not partisan issues. They are global imperatives and the foundation of peace, prosperity, and progress.
On Wings, that was a clip of United Nations Secretary General Antonio Guterres speaking at the high-level meeting marking the 30th anniversary of the Fourth World Conference on Women. Excerpts from a few of the many other speakers follow. Diane Keita is Executive Director of the United Nations Population Fund.
Mr. Secretary General, Madam President, Excellencies, esteemed colleagues, 30 years ago in Beijing, the world pledged to achieve gender equality and women's empowerment. 1 year earlier, at the International Conference on Population and Development in Cairo, government affirmed that sexual reproductive health and reproductive rights are a precondition for women empowerment and essential to dignity and development. Beijing and Cairo go hand in hand, mutually reinforcing and universal. Today, we thank the member states for their effort.
while significant progress has been made, it is fragile. Too many women still die giving birth. Too many women and girls are denied safety and opportunity. Millions of youth and marginalized people do not have their most basic needs met. And new threats are rising: climate change, increasing conflict, digital world where technology, including artificial intelligence, can be fabulous opportunities when used properly, instead of being weaponized against women and girls. Demographic shifts are reshaping societies. Rapid population growth in some regions, aging in others, rising migration, systems are strained, inequalities deepen, reproductive rights come under threat. Let us recommit to do better together and make sure that no woman should die while giving life. Let's invest in right and choices, the foundation of justice, prosperity, and peace. Merci.
I thank the Executive Director of the United Nations Population Fund. I now invite Ms. Reem Al-Salem, Special Rapporteur on Violence Against Women and Girls, its Causes and Consequences, to make her statement.
The Beijing Declaration and Platform of Action, the BDPA, gave the world a visionary blueprint that recognized the structural, societal, and individual causes of violence against women and their consequences. We must recommit to its promise with honesty and courage. That starts with returning to the original intent of the BDPA, not diluted, not reinterpreted, and to implementing it comprehensively and not superficially. Let me highlight six commitments that are especially urgent and pertinent today. First, we must reaffirm women's inherent dignity and humanity. The BDPA mentions dignity 7 times and humanity 5 times, reminding us that women are not a subset, but are half of humanity. Yet today, those words have vanished from our policy language as though women's most basic worth and rights could be set aside. If we lose the language of dignity and humanity, we lose the foundation of equality. Second, we must reclaim the material reality of being female. The BDPA references the term sex or a derivative of it 176 times, recalling that all major human rights instruments prohibit discrimination on that basis. And yet, 3 decades later, the architects of the BDPA would be in disbelief to learn that stating this truth is branded by some as hateful, outdated, and regressive. Third, we must confront the rampant commodification and objectification of women and girls. Their bodies, their sexuality, and even reproductive functions have been turned into products for the sale and purchase, creating patriarchal entitlements and control, both online and offline. The BDPA was gravely and rightly concerned with this exploitation, particularly of prostitution and trafficking for sexual exploitation, and urge states to prosecute those who profit from it. We must finally heed that call. Fourth, the BDPA identified aggression, colonialism, and foreign occupation as causes of grave violations. While governments stand idly by, women and girls, particularly in Palestine and in Afghanistan, are being intentionally and systematically targeted and destroyed. These atrocities and the impunity granted to their perpetrators expose the profound hypocrisy of governments who claim to defend women's rights while turning a blind eye to their annihilation. Fifth, the BDPA demanded accountability. But instead of an increased access to justice, we are seeing the opposite, on several fronts undermining rights hard won. Perpetrators of rape, trafficking, war crimes, and genocide walk free, flaunting their impunity while some governments boast of their support to them. And finally, the BDPA warned against excessive military spending, recognizing that militarization fuels violence against women while draining resources from peace, women empowerment, and ending violence, as well as social justice. Yet today, the global arms race intensifies, leaving women and girls to pay a hefty price. Excellencies, 30 years ago, states believed this agenda was achievable. If this was possible then, it is possible now, not as an act of charity, but as a necessity and undeniable right for women, for half of humanity. That half is watching, and that half will hold you to account. Thank you.
I thank the Special Rapporteur on Violence Against Women and Girls, its causes and consequences. I now invite Ms. Nadia Murad, Nobel Peace Laureate and founder of Nadia's Initiative, to make her statement.
I was once a young woman living in peace until ISIS captured me and countless other women and girls, shattering our lives in unimaginable ways. Hundreds of these women and girls, including my niece, my sister-in-law, and my cousins, are still missing in captivity in Syria. Since my escape, I have met many women who endured unimaginable suffering and whose strength is extraordinary. But strength alone cannot rebuild lives. They need action, they need justice, they need resources. Women's organization, the Lifeline in times of crisis, remain underfunded and excluded. Perpetrators of sexual violence continue to enjoy impunity. The international community must hold accountable regimes, groups, and governments that deny women and girls the rights, those that legalize child marriage, restrict education, or enact discriminatory laws. Justice must extend beyond individuals to the system and structures that perpetuate inequality. If we are serious about the Beijing Platform for Action, then we must do three things. Fund the women's organizations on the front lines. Guarantee women's full participation in peace and security. Hold perpetrators and oppressive systems accountable, because impunity should never be an option. These are not just policies, they are promises we owe it to every woman and girl. Sustainable peace is impossible while half of humanity's population is silenced or targeted with violence. 30 years after Beijing, reflection is not enough. We must accelerate. The next generation of women and girls deserve to inherit no more promises, but the reality of equality, justice, and dignity. Thank you.
I thank Nadia Murad, and I now invite the Executive Director of the African Women's Development and Communication Network to make a statement.
Memory Zande Kachambwa is Executive Director of the African Women's Development and Communication Network, known as FEMNET.
I stand before you not as a one voice, but many that carry the breath of African women and girls from the mountains of Kilimanjaro to the shores of Dakar, the streets of Harare, and the villages of Mali. 30 years ago, the Beijing Declaration lit a flame. Women and girls danced. We sang together. The moment was not only symbolic, it was a covenant. And yes, there has been progress on care work, gender-responsive budgeting, on women, peace, and security, on the girl child and climate justice. But let us be honest, even though this has entered the discourse, discourse has not delivered. There's been persistent and deliberate gaps, particularly the chronic underfunding of national gender institutions and the many sectors that shape our lives: health, education, agriculture, livelihoods, as well as public service provision. We have seen the erosion of women's organizing and feminist movements. We have seen reversals of hard-won gains and rights undermining our demands and struggle. We African women and girls demand bold, transparent, and participatory accountability. We insist on inclusion of women and girls in all their diversity. Civil society is not the enemy of the state. We are co-creators of development. We are guardians of democracy. We are the architects of liberation. The backlash that we face is not just against gender equality. It's against the truth. It is against freedom. It's against the principles upon which these institutions celebrating 80 years has been founded. We must affirm feminist principles that offer real alternatives to the broken system. Ubuntu, our shared humanity and interdependence, reparative justice for colonialization, debt, and climate harm. Africa each year loses close to $60 billion through illicit financial flows. These are funds and resources that can make a huge impact on women's rights and gender equality. Your Excellency, we also face a lot on our peace as a continent, on the extraction that we see of critical resources in the name of advancing climate transition. We see systematic violence. Women and girls deserve a life free of violence, free from the misogyny, free from the technology facilitated violence that we see. Women and girls deserve to live and to thrive in dignity and joy. UNGA 80 must rise to this moment of reckoning and make bold, unapologetic resolve to fund gender equality and women's rights. It is non-negotiable. Thank you.
Memory Zande Kachambwa is executive director of the African Women's Development and Communication Network, known as FEMNET. The next speaker, Nala Haidar, chairs the United Nations Committee responsible for implementation of CEDAW. That stands for the Convention on the Elimination of All Forms of Discrimination Against Women. Adopted at the third UN World Conference on Women in 1995, the CEDAW Treaty has been ratified by nearly every country in the world, except the United States.
I now invite Ms. Nala Haidar, Chair of the Committee on the Elimination of Discrimination Against Women, to make her statement.
30 years after Beijing, it must be said loud and clear, gender equality is not a favor. It's not optional. It is justice, peace, and progress for all humanity. Its powerful blueprint mandated the world to tackle 12 urgent areas: poverty, education, violence, decision-making, among others. And it transformed global policies. But let us be honest. Around the world, we witness a backlash against women's human rights, their underrepresentation in decision-making, online abuse and discrimination against women being coded into new technologies. Moreover, we are horrified by the impact of conflict on women and girls. This is why CEDAW, the committee and the convention matters more than ever. Beijing gave us the vision. CEDAW gives us the compass. The convention is legally binding. It holds states to account and measures progress and turns promises into rights that cannot be taken away. CEDAW covers every Beijing priority, defends women's economic rights, access to resources, calls for education, a force of transformation, places gender-based violence against women at the center of its concern and demands action. It advances women's voice in peace and security processes, and in that regard, CEDAW has just published an addendum on WPS.
WPS stands for Women, Peace, and Security. The speaker was Nala Haidar, chair of the United Nations Committee on the Elimination of Discrimination Against Women. You've been listening to excerpts from a high-level event convened by the UN General Assembly to share reports on the implementation of the terms to which the participant countries agreed at the Fourth World Conference on Women in Beijing. The entire event, consisting of many concise reports from all over the world, can be viewed on the UN TV website. For help finding the link, email wings@wings.org. Wings thanks all our supporters, including your local community radio stations, Suzette Cullen and Genevieve Vaughan, whose events can be found on the website maternalgifteconomymovement.org. Her books include The Gift in the Heart of Language, The Maternal Source of Meaning. The Wings sound logo is from Libana's album A Circle is Cast. I'm Wings series producer Frida Worden. This is the Women's International News Gathering.